From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan Senate rolls back paid sick leave and minimum wage laws.
They made it so that the state will still get to $12 an hour, but not until 2030.
And the Senate's moving to put the Mackinac Bridge Authority in control of the tunnel replacing Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac. We talk with the longest-serving member of that authority.
I guess I would just have to say that it is ill-conceived and clandestinely implemented.
A new documentary focuses on one woman's struggle to avoid being deported to Mexico.
This is a problem that we need to deal with. There are 11 million people here. We can't deport all of them. Congress needs to act. They can't just keep avoiding a decision.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As expected, Michigan's lame duck legislature today moved to scale back the minimum wage and paid sick leave laws. And that's exactly what happened today in the state Senate. We get the latest now with Michigan Radio's Shana Roth. So Shana, just to recap for everyone, nearly 400,000 voters signed petitions to get these issues on the November ballot. The Republicans felt they were going to lose there, so they adopted the laws pre-election and today changed them. What happened with minimum wage?
Well, with minimum wage, essentially, they made it so that the state will still get to $12 an hour, but not until 2030, which is 8 years longer than this initiative initially had. They also reinstated this lower wage for tipped workers. And this was something that initially tipped workers were going to be able to get that $12 an hour guaranteed minimum wage. Now it's back down to that $3, $4 range.
And what about the paid sick bill? How was that amended?
Yeah, that one, it got scaled back in quite a few areas. You know, it's going to reduce the total number of hours a person can earn. It would increase how long a person has to work to earn an hour. It would exempt certain employers and employees, and that includes employers that have 50 or fewer employees, which is quite a large number. Pretty much all small businesses would get exempt from this earned sick time bill.
So people who work for these small companies under 50 employees, out of luck, no guaranteed paid sick time.
Exactly.
How did Democrats react to all of this? It happened quickly, as you were saying. What was said? What was the mood in the chamber?
I mean, it was surprising. Usually when there's something that's so controversial like this, particularly something that Democrats have been talking against for quite a while when these ballot initiatives were initially adopted, they said, we don't want to be back here with you guys making a bunch of changes and effectively gutting these bills. So it was surprising today when only one Democratic senator, Senator Curtis Hertel, got up and made a speech, one speech on both the bills and said, I'm upset that I'm correct, that I said we were going to be back here and here we are. But that was it. And, you know, the bills went up on the board and then they were voted. And then that was that. It was actually kind of almost somber in a way. It was very surprising.
Now, am I correct that this is the first time in Michigan history that lawmakers are scaling back citizen initiatives in the very same session in which lawmakers have passed them? I mean, are there constitutional issues here?
That's what I have heard. I have not gone through and, like, you know, gone through all of the years, but it sounds like this would be the first time that that would happen. And Democrats are saying that, look, this is going to cause lawsuits. And there have been lawyers and people advocating for the original ballot initiative saying, you know, we're going to file lawsuits. You can't do this. However, we spoke with Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff, who said there is nothing in the state constitution that says we cannot make changes to these in the same session that we adopted the proposals. And he says that Democrats are relying on an opinion by former Attorney General Frank Kelly from 50 years ago, where he doesn't actually cite any actual cases. So we'll see.
So if these moves are upheld in what probably would be a very lively court battle, what would be the next option for Democrats?
Well, they'll have a Democratic governor here very soon, and they'll have her for 4 years. So it's possible they can try to get new bills that sort of go back to the old changes, and we could see some back and forth here. But Democrats would have to get some sort of majority in the legislature in order to do that.
Michigan Radio's Shana Roth. Shana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Should the Mackinac Bridge Authority have oversight over a tunnel to replace Enbridge Line 5 beneath the Straits of Mackinac? The State Senate Government Operations Committee today said yes as it approved a bill that does exactly that. Before the entire Senate votes on the bill, however, the bill's sponsor and other interested parties have said they will allow time to consider amendments. Barbara Brown is a member of the Mackinac Bridge Authority. Barbara, do you believe the Bridge Authority should have oversight over this tunnel?
Absolutely not. It is not why the Bridge Authority was created. The Mackinac Bridge Authority's purpose is completely separate. The Mackinac Bridge is a transportation facility, and it was built to transport vehicles and goods between the two peninsulas. And the purpose of the tunnel is so disparate from the purposes that the Mackinac Bridge Authority serves that it is an illogical and, I believe, an inappropriate use of the Mackinac Bridge Authority.
Who do you feel should oversee this tunnel?
Well, I am not anti-tunnel, and I believe a separate entity, a Straits Tunnel Authority, for example, would be a logical entity to oversee a utility tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac.
From what you know of the bill, Barbara Brown, what would Enbridge be responsible for, and what would be the Bridge Authority's responsibility?
Well, the Bridge Authority's ultimate responsibility would be ownership of the tunnel. And I have seen drafts of various agreements between the state of Michigan and Enbridge, and drafts of anticipated agreements between the Mackinac Bridge Authority and Enbridge. And they provide that the Mackinac Bridge Authority would provide the land for the tunnel on either shore. That would implicate the Mackinac Bridge Authority's powers of eminent domain. It would require the Mackinac Bridge Authority to have oversight. And certainly, if you own something, ultimately, you have responsibility and liability for that structure and that facility. So that, you know, just to name a few, and each of those duties of the Mackinac Bridge, there are many sub-duties and responsibilities and expenses. That would mean that the Mackinac Bridge Authority would have to hire personnel. We do not have environmental engineers or tunnel engineers. We do not have the staff and the expertise to oversee a utility tunnel. There certainly are other state departments, for example, the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Quality, that are better equipped to oversee something like a utility tunnel than would be a transportation facility like the Mackinac Bridge.
On Tuesday, some former members of the Bridge Authority joined with environmental groups to oppose the Line 5 tunnel plan. And interestingly, the authority's new chairman, Patrick Gleason, said he was surprised when this agreement was announced in October, said he would have liked more notice. And I'm wondering, how much communication did you on the Bridge Authority get from the Snyder administration as this tunnel plan was being agreed on with Enbridge?
I can speak for myself. I was the vice chair for 13 years until November 1st, and my colleague on the Mackinac Bridge Authority, William Gnatke, was the chairperson for 17 years until this past November 1st, and I am very comfortable speaking on his behalf. We essentially had no information and no contact from the governor's office prior to the October 3rd announcement, except I was informed the day before that the announcement was going to be made, and Bill Gnatke was informed 23 minutes before the announcement on October 3rd.
Why is this, do you think?
Well, they didn't want us to know what they were up to. That is the only conclusion that I can come to. This imposes a tremendous burden on the Mackinac Bridge Authority. And I recently read an article where DNR Director Keith Craig stated on the record that this has been in the works for 4 years. And people never authorized by the Mackinac Bridge Authority have been working on a plan and negotiating agreements and contracts, setting forth the terms that the Mackinac Bridge Authority would be bound by, and never has the Mackinac Bridge Authority to this moment ever authorized anyone to represent us, to negotiate us on our behalf, or to have anything to do with this tunnel agreement because we didn't know about it.
Barbara, how would you characterize the Snyder administration's handling of all of this from your point of view?
Whoa, it is such a complex and multifaceted issue and plan that it is very difficult to put it in a nutshell, but I guess I would just have to say that it is ill-conceived and clandestinely implemented. And it is very, very disturbing to learn on a day-to-day basis the number of people who have been involved in this and the amount of time that they have been involved. And it all comes down on the shoulders of the Mackinac Bridge Authority, and we have not been involved.
Does the Bridge Authority, Barbara, have any recourse to keep from being forced to oversee this tunnel?
Well, if it is presented to us and our chair person, Patrick Gleason, decides to bring this before the authority, we can always vote against it. And if Senate Bill 1197 is passed by the Senate, it would be my very sincere hope that the Bridge Authority would vote against this plan and not approve an agreement with Enbridge.
Do you have a sense how the vote would go on the authority? Do you think you've got the votes to say no?
I am ever hopeful, especially as more information about this plan is coming forward. It is very difficult for me to say at this point because there are newly appointed members to the authority. I do not know how they stand on this issue. It is a little troubling to me. I am the veteran on the Bridge Authority right now, and as of November 1st, there are four handpicked appointees by Governor Snyder. So on its face, it would look like this would be a very close vote. But I'm hoping that these new members, as they learn how the public feels about this, and it is very clear to me that the public is in quite an uproar, that our treasured Mackinac Bridge and the Mackinac Bridge Authority would be strapped with this very difficult and unpopular task of overseeing this tunnel.
Mackinac Bridge Authority member Barbara Brown, thank you so much for speaking with us, Barbara.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for your interest.
We reached out to the governor's office for comment on its communication with the Mackinac Bridge Authority. We did not get an immediate response. Still to come, we'll talk with our education commentator, Matinga Ragatz, about the changing relationship between schools and families. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From the moment Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, he threw down the gauntlet.
The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems.
Well, as we know, undocumented immigrants have been in the national spotlight as ICE makes arrests and deports them. What is that like for these immigrants in their homes with their families? The new film Lourdes by director Anthony Collings seeks to answer that question. Collings was a correspondent for CNN for 16 years. Before that, a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press. And these days, he's a lecturer in communication studies at the University of Michigan. Tony, welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So your film introduces us to Lourdes Salazar Bautista and her struggle to keep from being deported back to Mexico. Why was her story the one you felt was worth telling in your film?
So I was impressed by the fact that there are 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, and I want to tell the story of one of them. A lot of them don't want to appear on camera, understandably. They're very shy about the danger of being caught and deported. So I asked immigrant support groups, you know, is there somebody you know who would be willing? And they said, oh yes, Lourdes, definitely, because she wants publicity. She wants attention to her case, and she fought deportation for years.
Very publicly, which we follow in your film. So she first came to this country on a tourist visa in 1997. Why did she overstay that visa?
She came here for a better life for her children. She actually gave birth to her three children here in Ann Arbor, they are U.S. citizens. And that's what she told me, you know, that my goal was a better life for them.
And her husband, Luis, came undocumented. He came, slipped into this country and was deported in 2010.
Yeah, they worked out an arrangement with the government. She was arrested. Lourdes was arrested at her home and taken away in handcuffs in front of her children, which was traumatic for them. And then she was held for 23 days at a jail in Battle Creek. Then they worked out a deal that she could be released, but her husband had to leave the country.
And he did.
And he did.
But the next year, 2011, ICE came for her.
ICE came for her, and she fought it, and she had a lot of support from the community here in Ann Arbor, and she was able to get the support of the city council and churches and immigrant support groups. And year after year, she was able to postpone her deportation until Trump became president.
But it is worth noting her husband was deported and ICE was ready to deport her in 2011. And this was under the Obama administration, because sometimes I think people forget it didn't just all begin with Donald Trump's election.
That's right.
But when he was elected, how did things change?
So ICE became more aggressive and began deporting more people. And I think statistics show that there's been a tripling of deportations under Trump compared to Obama.
And what we really see through your film is as Lourdes shows up for her scheduled check-ins with ICE, she had a growing sense that it could be any time. And so the question is, do I not go to my check-in, or do I go and perhaps be put directly on a plane?
That's right.
And the effect through the entire family is really, really powerful, the way you show it.
That was one of the things I wanted to show. What does it mean to be undocumented and afraid of deportation? And what does it mean, especially for the children? I know from talking to her oldest daughter, Pamela, that she had serious psychological problems. She talked about being in therapy, having trouble at school. And also her sister, Lulis, has had important issues involving her emotional stability and difficulties at school. And then they have a son. Brian was able to visit his father in the summer in Mexico, but he said it was very painful to have to leave.
In fact, let's take a listen to a clip from your film, Lourdes. This is Pamela, the oldest child, and she's talking about what it was like when her father was deported in 2010.
My dad isn't here to see me go. He wasn't there when I started high school. He wasn't there when I finished middle school. He wasn't at my middle school graduation. He wasn't at my high school graduation. It's something really sad, and I guess I don't really know how I've been coping with it.
And I know this young woman is a student at Michigan State University right now, but boy, you really see how all of this lands very, very squarely on her shoulders, doesn't it?
Yes. And she's also very concerned about her sister, Lulis. When Lourdes was deported, she took all three children with her. The eldest, Pamela, was just there for a week and then came back here to Michigan because of being at Michigan State. Lulis, her sister, was in Mexico for 1 year and then decided that she really needed to come back. So she's now back here, and her sister is able to watch over her here.
You know, there are those, Tony, who are going to look at this story and they're going to say, look, they rolled the dice. Lourdes and her husband, they chose to break immigration law. He entered illegally. She chose to overstay her tourist visa. So they broke the law, and there are consequences for doing that. How do you answer that?
So technically, she didn't break the law. She entered legally with a visa. She overstayed the visa. That's a civil infraction. It's not a crime. But yes, he did commit a crime by entering illegally. My feeling is that this is a problem that we need to deal with. There are 11 million people here. We can't deport all of them. Congress needs to act. They can't just keep avoiding a decision. There needs to be some kind of path to legal status, either citizenship or permanent residence, something, rather than breaking up families. And it causes a tremendous toll on the individual immigrant, on her family, and on us as a society.
Because just saying follow the rules doesn't address the fact that the rules are broken?
Yeah. And I think it's a question of priorities. You know, there are people who have come here without documentation and then committed serious crimes. I think those people You know, if you're going to deport anybody, those are the people to deport. But Lourdes did not commit any crimes. She was a wonderful contributor to the community here. In fact, she helped run an after-school program at the library for the children of immigrants. And everyone who met her loved her. One of her friends said she's everyone's favorite aunt.
And I know that her story, it's clear there was a huge amount of support in the Ann Arbor community for her. And I know you're working on a second documentary, Immigrants in Michigan. What do you want to explore in that?
So I'm looking at other families, some more Latinos, but also Chaldeans here in Michigan. And I did interview a Chaldean man in prison after a number of Chaldeans were rounded up last year. And he was actually weeping during the interview because he was so distraught and so worried about the danger to him if he were sent back to Iraq, where his life would be in danger. Fortunately, he was later released on the orders of a judge.
Well, certainly your film, Lourdes, comes at a very timely moment as we think of images that we have just seen this very week of mothers and children being tear gassed at the Tijuana border by U.S. agents. And you'll be screening Lourdes at the Ann Arbor Downtown Library at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow evening. And we want you to know, all of you, that we put a link to his film at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. So it is there for you to watch this story of Lourdes. What do you hope people will take away from your film, Anthony?
What I really want is for people to have a deeper understanding what it's like to be an undocumented immigrant and in fear of deportation. And I'm hoping that it'll spark a debate. You know, what should we do? We can't just leave this, undecided. We need to do something to show compassion to these people at the same time, obviously enforcing the law as much as possible on the border.
It's a powerful film, Lourdes, by Anthony Collings. And we want to thank you so much for being with us to share your work.
Thank you.
Teaching has certainly gone through some major changes in the past decade, but parents don't always understand just how different school is today than when they were students, and that can lead to friction between parents and teachers. So let's talk about how to bridge that gap as we say hello to education consultant Matinga Ragatz here with us via Skype. So Matinga, you say there's a divide with parents on one side and teachers on the other. Give us an example of what that looks like. What's a common conflict?
Well, I wouldn't call it quite a divide, but it's definitely a changing relationships, right? So there are a lot of factors that kind of evolved this new relationship. And a common factor is that parents, like you said in your intro, they just don't recognize the school they went to. And it's difficult for teachers, a teacher who has been teaching 20 years, well, for her, it was a gradual transition. But to a parent, a first-time parent coming into the classroom, it is very intimidating.
So give me an idea, as a teacher, how is this expressed in something with a parent?
Okay, so for example, in a 10-minute parent conference, a parent may be exposed to, say, three different acronyms that they don't know, or four different technology tools, or two different ways of thinking, or maybe a no homework versus homework, and a lot of policy that they don't understand. And they may walk out of that conversation just scratching their head and asking themselves, wait, what?
And then what does that lead to?
It just leads to a them versus us culture. And it also, I think, most detrimental is that it makes it so that the teacher no longer owns the narrative as to what's happening in the school, because they're, it's very difficult for the schools to tell their story, to let the community understand what is it that they do for their students.
All right. So give us an idea of the ways that school and classrooms are different in 2018 than things may have been for parents who were in school, let's say 20 or more years ago.
Well, for one, there are different ways of looking at education, and specifically different tools that parents may not understand. I spoke to a parent who was telling me that homework time in their house is a little bit of a panic attack, because the child comes in with the Chromebook and the parent looks over the shoulder and they don't recognize what their assignments mean. And they're just in a panic. It's like, if this child asks me a question, I don't know how to help them. And so it's become a just a different scenario for parents.
Are we seeing that more in math, or are we seeing that really across the board in all the subjects?
Across the board in all the subjects, especially now that subjects are integrated. So a parent might be looking and saying, is that math? Is that science? What am I looking at?
Okay. So, you know, we talk about parent involvement as something that is kind of held up as super important to a student succeeding. But what I hear is that sometimes parents cross a line in that involvement.
Oh, sure they do. I know there is a fine line between advocating for one's child and straight up bullying. There's a self-esteem psychology that came in the 90s that really encouraged teachers to elevate children by telling them they're special. And really, that slowly evolved and got hijacked into a culture of not blaming the child for anything and removing all kinds of disappointments and all kinds of difficulties away from the child's life. And so some parents come in and they feel like any type of difficulties that their child experiences is their teacher's doing, or the school culture, or things like that.
Mm. So let's just say that there was a bad grade on an important test. And I'm thinking of someone who has now stepped away from high school teaching because she got very tired of this, a friend of mine who got tired of parents coming in and giving her what for because Johnny got a D and Johnny needs a better grade.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not Johnny's fault. It's the system, and everybody gets blamed except for Johnny. And there is a lot of science to go with the fact that, yep, there's a number of variables that have to do with Johnny's grade, and it's not necessarily the teacher's fault.
Now, Matinga, you talk with some teachers about this kind of, we'll call it a divide, this difference of opinion between themselves and parents. What do they have to say?
You know, it's a really interesting conversation that I had with some teachers, especially about this confusion and expectations for the community. Tom Torrento, who is the director of bands over at North High Schools, I think it's Grosse Pointe Public Schools. He's also the Teacher of the Year for Region 9. I asked him specifically, you know, what teachers could do to mitigate the confusion. And this is what he had to say.
I think we need to step back and go, what are the parents defining as the role of the teacher? Is it to teach, or is it to be a positive influence, or is it just a building with heat and food where a kid can go?
So what's he saying here?
Well, you can tell a confusion even inside. So the profession, as I said, it's evolved to a highly technical profession. And there is a lot more than just a read a book and translate it and give it to the student. I felt like he had such a good point where we need to just freeze and define the role ourselves as educators rather than expect the community to understand what our role is, our new role is.
And you talk with parents. So what does it look like from the other side? In what ways do parents get frustrated when it comes to building a relationship with their child's teacher?
Yeah, I had a chance to have some coffee with some parents. And, you know, it's different in different types of schools. So the urban schools, the parents are going to be thinking differently than in suburban schools or than in rural schools. So I had a chance to have some coffee with some suburban parents. And in their view, it's a lot more confusing. You know, they felt like they're involved parents. And I mean, like they have much more privilege to be able to volunteer and to be in the schools. And so all of these changes makes it very confusing to them. For example, one of the parents was saying that she volunteers in the classroom. She's a band parent, yet she volunteered specifically for a testing advisory committee. But within 20 minutes of being in that room, she just flooded by terminology and she just did not even understand. She had to ask the person that was running this meeting, hey, can you just speak in normal so that we can understand what you're saying?
To that point, what can schools and teachers do to help parents understand better what's going on?
Well, the schools are doing a ton, really. There's emails that go unread. There's newsletters that line the trash can. And there's informational meetings that they're not well attended. However, I think we need to just kind of change it up. And I can give you an example of Rebecca Drake, who is a fifth grade teacher in Genesee County. So she recently started hosting these quarterly dinners that her fifth graders cook. So of course, the kids are really excited to invite their parents to eat food that they prepared. But these meetings are not the typical informational events. These meetings are more community building. And they're conversations centered around her role, and the non-academic skills that she wants to teach to the kids, and to really reassure them that she's a team member in this project that they have in raising their kids. And it's just a softer approach. And if I can give a couple of pointers to parents, you know, they should ask whenever they're feeling lost. It's, you know, just take your teacher out for coffee and just, you know, teachers love to talk about their methodology, and ask the teacher, and don't go over the teacher's head, but ask the teacher, what does this mean, rather than trying to figure out yourself.
So that's a good start. And then you certainly drop some nuggets through our conversation when you talk about unread newsletters. And so parents need to have the kind of have their eyes open for what, communications. And if you don't understand, ask.
Ask, and you know, and make sure, and this again, this is just another nugget. Make sure that the community takes care of that health and well-being of your teacher. Another thing that you can do is when you're addressing teachers, don't blame them for ruining your kid's life for their academic career, but ask questions.
Education consultant Matinga Ragatz, great advice. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, the orders were clear to the 1970s era Detroit police decoy unit called Stress.
We want you to wander around, pretend to be drunk, pretend to be lost. We want you to try and get robbed. And then when the robber comes up and he's face to face with you, we want you to arrest him.
The result, dead civilians, dead officers. Detroit under stress. Next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the most controversial chapters in Detroit history is named STRESS. It's an acronym for Stop the Robberies and Enjoy Safe Streets. This Detroit police decoy unit operated from 1971 until it was eliminated by Mayor Coleman Young in 1974. The stories from the STRESS years are dark and they're violent, and that is the focus of an award-winning documentary film, Detroit Under Stress.
His last words were, "Oh," and I shot him right in the chest.
Black men were being hunted down. They were shooting them dead on the street.
The news media would blow everything that happened at Stress out of proportion and made us feel like we were mass murderers.
They were judge, jury, and executioner.
We knew that if one of our guys got shot even, or killed, the other guy was gonna go down.
Detroit police had killed more people per capita than any other city in this country. And those people were black.
It was a terror unit.
Stress to operate with impunity.
Its producer and director, David Van Wee, grew up in Detroit, and as we're about to hear, has a very close connection to this story. I spoke with him earlier this year, and let's revisit that conversation now. Start by telling us, David, how you discovered the story of the stress units.
Yeah, well, a full disclosure. So my father was one of the stress officers that was involved in the decoying and the decoy crew with Ray Peterson. And when I grew up, my father did not wear a uniform, and I had no idea what he did. I was told that he worked for the city. And so, you know, as you get older, you get little bits and pieces. And I remember specifically when I was in college, I was in ROTC, and we're driving. I wanted to practice shooting. So my father takes me to the gun range, and as we're driving there, he brought his .357. And as I'm holding the gun, I see there's notch marks in the bottom of his gun. And I turned to my father and I said, Dad, why are there notch marks in the bottom of your gun? And he turns to me and he says, why the hell do you think there are notch marks in the bottom of my gun? And so, of course, you take that in a little bit. And as a 18, 19-year-old, you kind of go, oh, my gosh. And then you get these little tiny bits and pieces of stories. And when about 5 years ago when we were in Detroit, I finally asked my father, I heard he was in this unit called Stress. And I said, what is this stress unit? What is it all about? And he finally sat down and he told me the whole story of stress. And I about fell over in my chair. I just couldn't believe what had happened, what the unit did, consequences of that unit. It was incredible. And I said, oh my gosh, Dad, you know, we got to share this story. And of course he gave me that sideways glance and said, nobody's talking to you, including me. But over time, it took me about a year, when my father finally agreed to be interviewed by me, it started to open the door to some of the other people in that unit. He was able to get me in touch with several people, including Ray Peterson.
Yeah, now Ray Peterson is the name you mentioned, and he's important because?
So Ray Peterson's important because he was involved in 9 of the fatal shootings. He was the decoy crew. It was Stress Crew 1. Now, Stress was made up of more than just decoy. It was about 100 guys, but only 20 of them did the decoy work because it was insanity. You're going to these police officers and you're saying, look, we want you to volunteer for this stress unit. There'll be no extra pay, but here's what we want you to do. We want you to go dressed as plain clothes and go into the worst parts of Detroit. We want you to wander around, pretend to be drunk, pretend to be lost. We want you to try and get robbed. And then when the robber comes up and he's face to face with you, we want you to arrest him. But don't worry, you're going to have 2 to 3 guys backing you up. Now, they'll be 100 yards away, but they'll come and help you as soon as something bad happens. I mean, can you imagine being asked to do something like this? And these guys volunteered to do it.
And what was happening when, if we're thinking of Detroit and what we see in your film, in Detroit in early 1971, this is 3.5 years after the big racial explosion, the rebellion of 1967. So what was going on with crime in Detroit that caused the DPD to say, we need to do this?
That's a great question. And it's so important and vital to this story because so many people forget about what it was like in Detroit in 1970. You had a murder rate that was up 300% from a decade earlier, and you had a robbery rate that was up 600% from a decade earlier. And the problem was, is when they were robbing you, in all likelihood, they were going to kill you because they didn't want a witness. And so the police show up, and you've got a dead body and no witnesses. Now what do you do? So the chief at the time, his name was Chief Nichols, got his crew together along with a guy named Inspector Bannon, and they decided that they wanted to start doing this proactive policing. This is where they were going to go out and try and find these guys who were doing these crimes and arrest them. But, of course, the problem was when you have a gun to your head and a knife to your stomach and you're being robbed, do you wait to get shot? You mean, because they have to wait until they actually get robbed. So they can't make the arrest until the robbery happens. But after the robbery, in all likelihood, you're going to get shot. And so the stress officers, of course, start shooting first. And it causes a big uproar in the city as it continues. And it was just a horrible position to put these police officers in. But at the same time, something had to be done.
And how effective was stress, David? What happened to Detroit's crime rate over those 2 or 3 years that it was in operation?
So stress was extraordinarily effective. Death is always a great deterrent. And when you've got these criminals out there and they start realizing and seeing what's happening with stress, then you watch the robbery rate start to plummet. And the murder rate, however, continues to climb. But they were extraordinarily successful in creating a decrease in the robbery rate. But with anything else, there are consequences to that.
Yeah. At what social cost? What about police citizen killings? What happened in Detroit there?
After the first year of stress, Detroit is the number one city where civilians are getting killed. But it's also the number one city where police are getting killed. So it really had consequences on both sides. And a lot of people forget that as well. They look at the 26 fatal shootings, which, of course, you know, are a consequence of that. But they forget about all the police officers that were not only killed, but the ones that were, you know, brutally shot that survived.
When you stop and you think about that evolving and then Coleman Young running for mayor in Detroit in 1973, promising to eliminate the stress units, and he's elected and he does. What happened to crime then?
Here's the interesting thing. So when Coleman Young's whole platform was to disband stress, stress was very unpopular at that point in 1973. The black community felt disenfranchised. Remember looking at history, 1964, you have the civil rights movement, but Detroit doesn't change. It stays the same. There's still an incredible amount of racism. There's still an incredible amount of pushing the black community into these two sections of the city called Black Bottom and Paradise Valley, where it's, you know, high rent, bad conditions. And so it's kind of this tinderbox that happens. And the communities continues to be outraged. And so Coleman Young steps in, sees it as an opportunity, and says, look, we're going to disband the stress unit. So in 1974, when he wins the election, he disbands stress, and the crime rate goes all the way back up to pre-stress levels. It was almost like he was giving the city a pass. And not only that, what was really interesting is that Coleman Young's personal security were all stress officers. He moved them from stress to his personal security.
When you think of the officers, you say there was about 100 in the unit, only about 20 or so actually acted as decoys. So who volunteered? And I'm wondering particularly, any officers of color?
There was. So Stress actually had a black decoy crew called Stress Crew 7. And it was made up of three African-American men who volunteered for the unit. And they would, of course, go out and do the same thing. Now, what was interesting about Stress as well is that within the police department at that time, racism was rampant. It was horrible. There were guys that were getting assigned a African-American partner, and they were putting up a piece of cardboard in their car between them.
Yeah, we actually heard that story from former Detroit Police Chief Ike McKinnon, and he described what it was like for him as a rookie officer, and it absolutely fit with that. He even had weapons drawn on him as a police officer heading home during the rebellion of 67. That is, yeah, we certainly explored that. So what was the result then of having that stress unit operating? How did that impact racism in the department?
So what's interesting is that within the stress unit itself, there really was no racism. They really worked together well, and they worked together as a unit. And even though they had specific missions and targeted areas where sometimes they would only use, the African-American crew, and then the white crew would go to somewhere else, they would mix and they would, pair up for certain decoy missions and so forth. And so I think it was a very different level of policing, almost like men who join the military and are in combat together. Because really, when you look at Detroit at that time, really was almost a combat zone.
So crime goes down while the stress units are on the streets. Crime goes back up, rebounds, ricochets back up when it was eliminated. So were law-abiding citizens hurt by the units, or were they hurt when the units were disbanded?
So, it depends on your view, of course. The black community living in Detroit has every right to be upset. The racism and the way that they were treated was horrific. At the same time, I'll tell you a quick story about a cousin of my father's. Her name was Roberta, and she was deaf. And she wanted to live in the city. She loved the vibe of the city. She loved the culture. And so she moved into the city. And as she's coming home late one night, she comes in the house. And what she doesn't hear is that there's two people that are robbing her house. And as she comes in, they brutally attack her and kill her. My father went to the scene, and he said that there was blood everywhere. He said she put up a hell of a fight, but they killed her. Now, was my family concerned about the people that were there bombing it? Were they hurt by this? Absolutely. Did they care what the economic circumstances were of the people that were in there robbing them? Not at that point, because it's personal. So if you're one of the people that's been attacked, or you're one of the people that's been robbed, or one of your family members has been killed, you're extraordinarily upset that stress isn't there. If you're on the other side of the issue, and you're upset at the amount of shootings that are happening by police against the African-American communities, then for you, it's a different take. So, and that's why this is so controversial, right? It's so difficult to come up with the right solution, because when you have such an aggressive and proactive policing solution, you're going to have consequences that are going to be impactful to people on the other side, right? Because the people that they shot, even though they were robbing someone or committing crimes, they have families as well. And so it's a very tough situation.
How did your dad feel about the film once he saw it all done?
My dad's a very hard man, as you can imagine. And when you hear some of the things that he did in the film, you kind of get a different flavor of maybe how I grew up. he's not, he never beat us. He didn't hit us. But he was, you know, he was a hard man. And when I first made my first cut of this film, I wanted to run it by him, of course. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to, because we do show both sides. You know, we have Mayor Kenneth Cockrell, who was mayor of Detroit previously, Ron Scott, who was not only involved in the anti-stress movement, but has been an advocate against police brutality all of his life. Melba Boyd, who was related to three men who were basically at war with stress and were shooting stress officers, and tells her side of the story. And so, you know, you have these things in the film that, that relay both sides. And I thought, oh my God, you know, he's just going to tear this apart. He's going to be angry. He sat down and watched the whole film, didn't say a word. And when it ended, you know, I just looked over and I said, Dad, what did you think? And he just looked at me and he said, that's good. I said, that's it? He's like, yeah. He said, you told the whole story. And I said, you know, you're not upset at anything. You don't want to change anything. And he says, nope. He goes, that's what happened. And that was it. And, you know, and he's talking about, you know, some of the, you know, pretty bad things he did. And, I think a lot of these guys, now that they're getting older, realize that this was their chance to tell their story. And so they really opened up, you know, especially, you know, Ray Pearson. Jesus, that was an incredible interview. And talk about a hard man. I tell people, regardless of whether you were a good guy or a bad guy, you did not want to come across Ray Pearson. He's not the guy you wanted to interact with at all.
Was he the commander, stress commander?
He was what they called the crew chief of Stress Crew One. He was one of the first people that they brought in. And you know, back in that time, too, you know, you had the supervisors were all World War II guys. And then the stress officers were, most of them were Korean, Vietnam vets. So, you know, you have these, you know, people that have been involved in war and those type of strategies, and they're bringing them to the police department. And that was another reason why, you know, it was so aggressive, was because the people that were running it were all military guys, really. And the people that were, you know, on the ground had been through Vietnam. So, you know, they wanted to go home at night.
David, I know you've screened the film across the country. And by the way, you've racked up a number of awards. What kind of audience reactions are you getting? What kind of comments?
It's all across the same thing. It's all across the board. We've had people walk out of the theater because they're furious about it. We've had people walk up and say, you know, thank you so much for finally letting the police officers have a voice. Because what's interesting about this as well is that typically we never hear from the police officer. And remember, the stress guys haven't talked to anybody in almost 50 years. We've never heard from them. And that's another thing that makes this so compelling, is you finally see the impact that this type of work had on them and the impact of on their side of having their friends and their fellow officers killed. And we kind of forget that piece. It's very easy to get into the narrative that, you know, that these were just white racist killers out to kill black people. You know, was there some racism involved? Did they do horrible things? Sure there was, absolutely. But I also think it's a product of what they were sent to do. And so the audiences have been great. There's only been one that they had to shut down in Connecticut because it got a little heated. But beyond that, people have been very respectful. Everybody has shared their views on both sides. And really, the purpose of the film is to continue that conversation about how do we solve this crime, because it's happening right now in Chicago.
Well, as you pose the question in the trailer to your film, how do you stop crime in a city out of control?
Yes. And if you listen to what Rahm Emanuel's statement was, well, we just need to instill more values and more morals. Well, that's great, but that's going to take quite a while to start turning that if that's necessarily what needs to be done. How do you help those families today?
The film is Detroit Under Stress, and David Van Wee is producer-director. David, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.